From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a different approach to investing in Detroit's neighborhoods, and it took two outsiders to bring it.
We're not only interested in Detroit's real estate, we're interested in Detroit's history. And we're not just interested in Detroit's houses, we're interested in their people.
Michigan's travel and tourism industry ready to build on a strong summer.
Traditionally, Michigan's tourism season has been the summer months, and more and more we're expanding that into fall and into winter, and Michigan really becoming a four-season destination.
One woman's story of recovery from opioid addiction that began with the very first pill.
Honestly, it was all over with from there. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what I was doing or what I was getting myself into. I thought I was just having fun.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you were beginning classes at one of Michigan's public universities on this day in the year 2003, you'd be paying about 40 cents out of every dollar of your school's operating costs. Today, you're paying 70 cents. Michigan's public schools have had to shift so much more of their operating cost onto students because the state has so drastically cut higher ed funding. That's the conclusion of a just-released report from the Michigan League for Public Policy. Gilda Jacobs is president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy. Let's start with these troubling findings about student debt and shrinking support from the state. Gilda, you say not only are Michigan college students paying more of the operating costs, they're graduating with more debt?
Sure. You know, what you really need to understand is that there's what we call a perfect storm here in Michigan. We have skyrocketing tuition, deep cuts to state aid for universities, and funding for need-based financial aid that's been slashed over, you know, the last number of years, really since 2003. So what you have is really what you hit the nail on the head, talking about the shift to students to now having to pay 70% of their college expenses themselves. And they end up leaving school with a huge financial debt, a huge, averaging about $30,000 a year.
Yeah, that was pretty stunning when I saw that. And how does that nearly $30,000 in loan debt for Michigan graduates, how does that compare with other states?
Well, Michigan is the sixth highest in the United States for tuition costs. And you know, we're way beyond other states in terms of the debt that students are saddled with when they leave.
I believe I saw ninth highest in the nation.
Ninth highest, correct.
And then state funding in that same period of time. What have we seen since 2003?
Well, there's been a dip. If you take a look at the graphs, and we've got a report out that folks can go to on our website, you just see this gradual falling off of state aid. You know, it's very easy for legislators when they create a budget in Michigan to be able to put less money into the universities because, you know, the legislators think, well, you know, those students can, pay more out of their pocket, or their parents will pay more, or they'll go and get a scholarship. So there's been this chipping away of money from higher ed because they wanted to use that money elsewhere in the state budget. And we see that from the graphs.
But haven't we seen most states, Gilda, have to cut higher ed funding to get through the Great Recession? And wasn't Michigan hit harder than most other states?
Sure, Michigan was hit harder, but we also know that the economic implications of being saddled with debt also really hurts the economy. You know, we have kids that get out of school, young people that get out of school that can't start families, they can't buy a house. I was on vacation speaking to a professor from the University of Iowa, and you know, he brought up to me the fact that his kids will never be able to buy a house, and that he and his wife aren't in the position to be able to give them money to go and buy a house, and that's because both of his kids are saddled with such high debt. And that's just an example of what we're seeing all over the state, and certainly in Michigan. So I think we really do need to reinvest money into higher ed. We certainly have to take a look at kids who are in financial need. We've really slashed our need-based scholarships over the years. In fact, if you're over 30 years old, and you know, in Michigan in particular, we have to upskill and retrain people for kind of the new economy in Michigan. There's no funding available for you to get some extra help if you need to go back to school.
So what is the challenge that this report that you released today, what's the challenge to state lawmakers and also to the universities?
Well, I think the challenge for our legislature is to kind of put their money where their mouth is. They want to create talent. They want to keep and retain talent, those that have gone through our universities. And in order to do that, I think they have to start investing more money to bring those numbers back up. And then on the other hand, the universities also have to look at stronger tuition restraint or tuition reduction. Everybody has some responsibility to do what they can to bring down these costs. Also, as I mentioned before, the state really does need to look at more need-based financial aid programs, and that's something also that some of the universities can do as well, especially if they have big endowments.
Gilda Jacobs is the president and the CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy. Their new back-to-school report can be found on their website. Great to talk with you, Gilda. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Kids all across Michigan got packed off to school today, and that marks the end of the summer tourism season. We wondered how Michigan's travel industry fared through the summer of 2016. Here with us is Michelle Grinnell from Travel Michigan. It is a little early, Michelle, to figure out how the Labor Day weekend itself went in terms of money spent by tourists. But what's the verdict, really, for the summer season as a whole?
Overall, we are looking at another really strong summer here in Michigan. You know, we had warm temperatures, we had low gas prices. We're seeing more and more people interested in all that the state has to offer. And so it's always with tourism, it's hard to predict. There's kind of a lag between data, but the indicators that we look at, things like hotel occupancy and hotel rates and revenue per available room, are all, through July, they were all up over where they were last year, which is a great indicator of a strong summer. You know, you look at things like fishing license sales and recreation passport sales from the Department of Natural Resources, and those were all up year over year from where they were at least during the midpoint this summer. So all of those kind of early indicators show that it's another strong summer here for the travel and tourism industry in Michigan.
Did we see this pretty much spread across the state, or did some areas of Michigan, you know, reap a richer summer than others?
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the things that we're seeing is that really across the state, it's been a strong year. So, you know, certainly you have your places like Mackinac Island and Traverse City that are always going to be very popular summer destinations. But really, all corners of the state we're hearing had a good summer. And compared to their own numbers from the previous year, we're doing well this summer. You've got places like Munising and Pictured Rock boat cruises that had approximately 10% up in ticket sales over last year. And all of those sorts of places are doing well. And it's one of the things we've been talking a lot about this summer. It's kind of the hidden gems. There are a lot of great destinations in Michigan. So if you've been going to the same place every year, maybe this year was the year to try something new.
Michelle, it has been 10 years now since the state started requiring districts, school districts, to start the academic year after Labor Day to give the tourism industry one last big Labor Day weekend hurrah. But we are seeing a steady increase in districts asking for waivers to start before Labor Day. And we know that starting this school year, all Michigan schools that get state aid have to have 5 more days of instruction for 180 days of school. Is it time to take a new look at that no class before Labor Day law?
Well, you know, the Michigan Lodging and Tourism Association has really kind of been the leader on this. We do know that it does help the tourism industry, and that the industry really across the state has really supported that after Labor Day school start date. But I think, again, what we're seeing as well is that traditionally Michigan's tourism season has been the summer months, and more we're expanding that into fall and into winter, and Michigan really becoming a four-season destination. So, I mean, I think it's something everyone's looking really closely at, and obviously ultimately it will be up to the legislature to decide that, but we do know that it does help the tourism industry here in the state.
Michelle, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
That's Michelle Grinnell with Travel Michigan. Happy 906 Day. Michigan's Youpers want us all to know this is the day we should celebrate what they consider to be America's greatest area code. Bugsy Sailor is the self-titled official, unofficial ambassador of the Upper Peninsula. Bugsy, just what's so special about the 906 that it deserves its very own day?
Well, as you know, we Youpers are a unique breed to begin with, but I think what makes 906 really, really unique is that it's so defined by the region and as the peninsula itself, and it's exclusive to the UP, and you can pinpoint our area code looking at the entire country of the U.S.
What are some of the best ways to celebrate 906 Day?
Well, you're going to have to cut me off, but there's a lot.
Well, give us a whirl.
And eating a pasty is a good way to start. I think it's a good time to pull out some plaid and some flannel, warm up the sauna, and, you know, play some euchre or some cribbage with some friends. And, of course, one of the best things you can do is get outside and go for a paddle, a hike, a swim. Anything to enjoy the great outdoors.
And I noticed as I looked on 906day.com, we might sing the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald while we do all of these.
Yeah, it's always a good day to remember that that story and the lives lost and pay tribute to them.
Bugsy, if you could choose only one word to describe the Upper Peninsula as someone who's never been there, what would that word be?
Paradise.
Very good. That probably does say it all. Why is that?
It's such a pristine place. I mean, it's a wonderland for outdoor activities and Lake Superior, and it's the largest lake in the world. And the air is fresh, and there's so much green space. It's an outdoor playground for anybody who's willing for an adventure. And yes, four full seasons to enjoy, and there's lots of variety.
Bugsy Sailor, always ready to sing the praises of the Upper Peninsula. I think we in Ann Arbor and Southeast Michigan might pass on the flannel because we're around 90 today, but we'll take a rain check on the flannel, but definitely with you on the pasty and all the other great ways to celebrate 906 Day. Bugsy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You talk about investment in Detroit and names like Gilbert or Illich come to mind. And certainly they have led the way in reshaping the look of downtown Detroit. But we're going to look at investment in Detroit's neighborhoods. Andrew Cullum and David Alade moved to Detroit recently and they launched an investment company called Century Partners. Their idea, invest in Detroit's neighborhoods and historic homes and in doing so close the wealth disparity gap by helping people invest in the rehabilitation of their neighborhoods. Andrew, David, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you so much, Cynthia. Yeah,
thank you.
Now, you both chose to give up jobs, pick up sticks, and come and move to Detroit. What were you each doing before you came here? What were you doing, Andrew?
I was living in Mississippi, and I had started a real estate company there. I started with five houses, and I built up that real estate portfolio to about 300 apartment units and 20 houses. So I felt like I was pretty strongly invested in Mississippi, and I felt good about that investment. I had a couple employees that worked for me. So I could kind of travel anywhere I wanted and sort of start fresh somewhere new, and Detroit was the place that I set my eyes on.
And we're going to talk about that in a moment. First, let's get the backstory, and David, tell us what you were doing and where you were.
Yeah, sure. So I'm from New York, born and raised, and I've never left, really, until moving to Detroit. I did investment banking for a number of years at two firms, Barclays and Credit Suisse, and primarily focused in the kind of asset finance world.
You, Andrew, decided Detroit was where you wanted to be, and why was that?
Believe it or not, it was because of a book I read. I'm one of those type of people that I actually do make decisions based off books, sometimes for good, sometimes for not. But so this one was a good one. I read a book called Arc of Justice, which tells the history of the Great Migration and Detroit and the automobile industry. But it focuses all that through the story of a doctor named Dr. Ossian Sweet, who was a doctor in the Black Bottoms who moved to Detroit from Florida. And he made the American dream come true for himself. And he wanted to buy a house in a nice neighborhood. And he found a house in a white neighborhood. And the neighborhood wasn't accepting of him. And there was a lot of violence. In America around housing at the time.
And we're going back quite a few decades.
Yeah, we're 1910, 1920s. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And so that book really inspired me. It made me want to move to Detroit and make that book into a movie and get involved in housing revitalization. And it started making me research Detroit more and pay more attention to Detroit. And so I started thinking about, well, if I want to do a business, it's never fun to do a business by yourself. So I'm like, who's the smartest guy I know of my generation that I could really think would be a good partner for this type of venture? So I'm hanging out with David in New York, and I started trying to pitch him on Detroit, and he literally ridiculed me, Cynthia.
I was worried about him. Man.
You laughed. No, you're like, what?
I thought the Mississippi Sun had got to him over some time. I mean, it was real traumatic, I imagine, being down there. But, you know, I actually cover the big three auto companies, so Ford, GM, and Chrysler. So I was probably in Detroit or the Detroit metro area probably once a quarter for 6 years. And I think when I first started working, it's in 2009, and you had two of the big three auto companies were kind of in bankruptcy, emerging from, and another one, they were doing big capital raises to, you know, prevent bankruptcy. So I did kind of come off because my professional career with a slightly negative conception of what was happening in Detroit, and it was a place that was some sense of desperation, definitely financial liquidity issues. And when Andrew came to me and talked about investing in Detroit, all I really had heard was, you know, struggling auto companies, dilapidated housing, really bad crime. But I think about 2 years ago, you know, I started, you know, really thinking about, you know, where I wanted my life to lead, and you know, the things that I really cared about, and I thought about applying to B school. And during that process, they really force you to think about what matters. And to me, you know, I grew up in South Jamaica, Queens. You know, went to school in Upper East Side, went to Columbia. I saw firsthand just huge, you know, disparities in education, you know, in health.
And income. Yes.
And for me, I think the source or one of the sources for those disparities across those fields is wealth. And if you look at how wealth is created in the U.S., it's primarily via home ownership, either owner-occupied homes or investment properties. And I thought Detroit would be an amazing place to, you already had a ton of houses. You had a really strong percentage of home ownership, actually, relative to any top 20 city. Be an amazing place to actually help address that wealth disparity and do so on a profitable basis, where the folks who stuck with Detroit through the worst of times can actually fiscally and economically benefit from the resurgence that's happening here.
So when did you both come plant your roots here and say, all right, it is now time to put out our shingle, if you will, as Century Partners and start working?
I would count it in June of 2014 when we made our first trip together here.
And the bankruptcy was...
Yeah, we were definitely following the bankruptcy,
yes.
The news. And he convinced me to start looking at it again. So we took a trip out here. We walked all these neighborhoods, you know, Palmer Woods, Indian Village, Boston Eddies, Sherwood Forest. Fell in love with the city again. And the people. And they were as pleasant and friendly as people from the South, you know. So... A lot of them are from the South,
Let's do it. So I guess, tell me what it is, David, that Century Partners does that's different and unique.
I think there are a couple things. I think particularly, again, I'm from New York, and so when development happens in New York, it happens, you know, in tandem with displacement. And that's because those communities are primarily renter communities. In Detroit, there's a unique opportunity because of the home percentage of home ownership, particularly in the neighborhoods that we're operating in. We have an ability to come into neighborhoods, do holistic, targeted investments, activate formerly vacant and blighted structures, and in so doing, you know, develop and bring resources to a neighborhood without displacing the folks that are currently there. So in that way, you know, I think in New York, a developer comes in, renters get displaced, and the developer captures all the upside. And here, the people who, again, stuck with Detroit, they're seeing their home values increase. And we've seen it just since we bought our first house in August 2014, home values increased dramatically. I think the second thing I think that makes us a bit unique is, you know, part of our philosophy is really to kind of democratize access, you know, to, you know, home ownership and real estate, not only in Detroit, but in other places as well. And we have an investment model and a fund that allows us to, I guess, two things, invite our friends and family, you know, participate in our Detroit investment. So they can invest in our fund and gain, you know, what we hope to be really strong returns. I think more interestingly is we have an avenue where current Detroiters, they can invest in our fund. You know, they, in exchange for some combination of, you know, cash and equity, they can give us a house, you know, maybe that was sitting next door to them that they bought for a couple $100 from a tax foreclosure auction a couple years ago. And those folks would also benefit from the rise in appreciation we hope to deliver.
Which goes back to that goal to tackle the wealth disparity that
absolutely
exists.
Definitely.
Tell me what neighborhood you're focusing on. It's a big city, lot of acreage,
yeah,
huge city. So I'm sure you had to be strategic and smart.
Strategic, absolutely. So we really wanted to focus on a transition neighborhood, a neighborhood that we thought could either be a tipping point in a negative way or a tipping point in a positive way. So we focused our first investment on Atkinson Street, which is one block south of Boston Edison. So Boston Edison is a really strong anchor neighborhood, a lot of beautiful homes, really the first suburb in Detroit, probably one of the first suburbs in America. The houses were fairly stable. There was a lot of home ownership, and there wasn't that many vacant homes. But Atkinson Street was a little bit more dilapidated. There were more vacant homes. And we thought, all right, we want to go leverage the positive benefits of Boston Edison, but we want to invest really strong. We want to put a really strong investment in this one street. So we started with one house on that one street. Then we quickly expanded to five other homes. We have 15 units on just Atkinson Street. So I would say we sort of have an Atkinson Street investment, which is really close to Boston Edison. And then we also have the North End, which is on the other side of Woodward, where we have some multifamilies that were invested. That is a similar investment thesis in the sense that they're all the units are very close to one another. Mm-hmm. So I think in Detroit, you really have to be strategic because it's a very block-to-block city. Certain blocks are very dilapidated, a lot of crime, and other blocks are very safe and very stable. And we really want to use the city's investment in certain neighborhoods, in the natural investment in certain neighborhoods, to expand that footprint so that where there's a strong neighborhood in the periphery, there's another neighborhood that's getting stronger as well.
How have you been received by the neighbors where you're developing and where you're working?
Before we renovated a single home, we actually knocked on our neighbors' doors. So we went up and down Atkinson. We had a little survey we had printed out to really get to know our neighbors. You know, we learned a ton about them. I mean, we definitely thought there was a high degree of home ownership, but to actually see multiple people who had lived in the same home for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, mm-hmm. and they welcomed us. Many of them welcomed us into their home.
I think it helped that I lived in the neighborhood. So when I first moved here, mm-hmm. I moved into our first house. And I was fixing it up a little bit by myself, and then David said, "This is going too slowly. We need to hire professionals. You're not a hipster." But it definitely helped that I moved here first, and I really got to know the neighbors, and there was a little bit of skepticism at first. I think the skepticism—
Developers, that connotation is not always a happy one for people.
Absolutely. Now, in the neighborhood, I think that the skepticism that I've seen in the neighborhoods around developers is really slumlords. Someone that's going to buy a house, because these are old historic homes, they're really expensive to fix up. So to get them properly fixed up, it's a costly expense. So I think there was some skepticism and some fear that we wouldn't really fix up the homes and that we would just throw a whole bunch of people in them, like throw 20 people into a huge home and not really fix it and like not really live in the neighborhood, not really see what type of damage that those people were doing to the neighborhood because we weren't there. It wasn't in our backyard. Once I think they saw us move in, they saw the quality of the renovations that we were putting in, and they saw the diligence and that we put in our screening process, because we really only want to rent to people who want to be in the Detroit neighborhoods, mm-hmm. who want to have a positive impact on Detroit's neighborhoods. So that, I think, gives us more credibility. And also, when people get to know you, they typically seem to, you know, people at this point, they know us in our areas. I mean, we're around, so.
Now, one of you tossed out kind of joking about the hipsters, but let me ask you this about your thoughts about the dynamics between the longtime black residents of neighborhoods and some of the new Detroiters were coming in who are often young, often white. I mean, that term hipster is kicked around. But what have you seen and how do you see that working together for Detroit's neighborhoods?
I mean, I see it working together very well. And I think what they really care about is making sure that, you know, their neighborhoods are treated with respect. And I think that's what was able to help lend, you know, really strong credibility over time with our neighbors for Andrew and I. Because we took the time to really bring really strong, you know, tenants and residents to the area. In our experience, you know, our neighbors didn't care if they're white, black, purple, yellow, as long as they're respecting the property. You know, they're not, you know, throwing loud parties. We're doing all the lawn maintenance and snow removal, and they're saying hello to their neighbors, and they're being respectful, and they're cleaning up after their dogs. I mean, that's really what people care about.
And if they don't, they know who to contact. I mean, the thing is, the neighbors have our phone numbers. So when they're unhappy with something, they let us know.
What do you both see as the key to a Detroit with economically healthy, active neighborhoods? There's been so much attention on downtown and midtown and Corktown. You're focusing attention on the neighborhood. So what would that look like? I'll let you take that one first, Andrew.
Okay. That's a really interesting question. I think that, one, you're definitely going to need a lot more commercial development in the neighborhoods. I think that's really part of the key to our success in the future will be our ability to have strong, original commercial enterprises. I think that the neighborhoods that are making really good comebacks, they have that in place. So I think we have the beautiful homes, so we don't have to worry. The matter of, you know, making those beautiful homes renovated and habitable again, that's just a financing thing that can be resolved really through numbers. I mean, that can be resolved. But you got to have commercial there, and I think you have to have really smart, engaged developers that look and feel to some degree like the people in the community. Because I do think that there's certain credibility that we have because we look like the people in the community. We can talk like them. We like the same music. To some degree, we can talk about sports the same. There's just an element of ease of communication that I think is going to be important to bridge the transition so that the neighborhoods are both diverse and inclusive, but also dynamic. And I think a lot of long-term Detroiters, black or white, realize that for a city to be dynamic, it has to have new people. I mean, a dynamic city accepts new people well, and it lets people leave well. So I think that Detroit is in a position to really accept lots of new people very well, because naturally Detroiters are very friendly. But I think that you do have to respect Detroit. That's one thing I know. You have to come to Detroit with respect. And I think the fact that we read books about Detroit, we know about artists about Detroit, we know about the history of what they think about different politicians from different decades, we wonder and talk about it because we're not only interested in Detroit's real estate, we're interested in Detroit's history, and we're not just interested in Detroit's houses, we're interested in their people. So I think that lends us an easy ability to sort of navigate that transition, because we do need inclusive, diverse neighborhoods. You know, I think that is necessary, and a lot of Detroiters know that.
Where, David, do you see both of you in Century Partners, say, in 10 years, in 20 years? Where do you see your scope in the city?
That's a big question. We're taking it one day by day. but I'd say if I had to... you know, really, you know, take a stab at that. My dream would be really to create more Century Partners. You know, I love, you know, I think you mentioned earlier at the outset, you have the Dan Gilberts and the Illiches. You know, those are, when folks think about development, those are the faces that come to mind. And for me, I think what would mean a lot to me is to expand the scope for what a developer is. You know, I think also typically there's a negative connotation I found when it comes to development. You know, I think development really is, as a developer, that's a huge, a powerful role. To be able to kind of shape a community, shape, you know, potentially how folks interact and engage and kind of develop, you know, what makes a community attractive to people. That's a lot of power there. And I think if we can broaden the scope of folks who have, you know, ability to develop, you know, to be developers, we'll have better communities. We'll have strong communities. We'll have more diverse communities, because I think you'll have a broader range of experiences that are woven into the fabric of what a community is. So I would love, for, you know, to help, maybe this help Andrew and I can help create a wave or facilitate a wave of more diverse, you know, developers to do thoughtful development in places that need it the most.
David Olade, Andrew Colom of Century Partners, interesting approach to development. We want to thank you so much for being with us to share it.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. We really appreciate your time.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's being called the worst drug crisis in American history, the addiction to opioid prescription painkillers. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tell us opioids were involved in nearly two-thirds of the deaths from drug overdoses in 2014. That's 29,000 lives lost. The numbers are staggering, but what's causing the problem? And why are so many of the victims white American women? This report is from the BBC's James Fletcher.
I remember looking at some of the early federal reports involving opioid painkillers and overdose deaths, and they had increased so rapidly. When I was looking at the data, I was convinced someone had put a decimal point in the wrong place.
This is Dr. Andrew Kolodny talking about working in addiction medicine in New York City in the early 2000s. Opioids are painkillers which have a similar effect to heroin and are derived from the same source, opium.
This sharp increase was very real, and what we would ultimately come to recognize is that we were at the beginning of a new, very severe epidemic.
Dr. Kolodny is now a senior scientist at Brandeis University in Massachusetts and executive director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. He says that traditionally, opioids were only given to people with terminal cancer or used briefly after major surgery. Other uses of these highly addictive drugs were considered too risky. But in the late 90s, that reluctance began to change.
34 million adults suffer from chronic pain.
The reason that the medical community began to prescribe opioids so aggressively is that we were responding in many ways to a brilliant marketing campaign that had been launched by the maker of an opioid pain medicine, a drug called OxyContin.
We doctors were wrong in thinking that opioids can't be used long term. They can be and they should be.
That's marketing material from the 1990s produced by the makers of OxyContin, Purdue Pharma. There was also lobbying to get pain classified as a vital sign, an objective measure like temperature or pulse. Hospitals had to screen all patients for pain on a scale of 1 to 10, and their funding was in part contingent on lowering those pain scores with aggressive treatment. Prescriptions for opioid painkillers exploded.
Rates of overdose deaths begin to soar. So from 1999 to 2014, 250,000 Americans have died of an opioid overdose. Today, there are more Americans dying of drug overdoses than dying from motor vehicle crashes.
Opioids also kill more Americans than guns every year.
So this is the worst drug addiction epidemic in United States history. We have about 10 to 12 million Americans on opioids chronically. So many Americans on opioids chronically that drug companies can now make money selling medicines to treat the side effects from being on opioids chronically.
If you need an opioid to manage your chronic pain, you may be so constipated. It feels like everyone can go, except you.
It's an astonishing sign of how bad the epidemic has become. During this year's Super Bowl, the most watched television event of the year, with the most expensive advertising, an ad was shown for a medicine to treat opioid-induced constipation.
Made on behalf of those living with chronic pain and struggling with OIC.
When we look at the specific groups worst affected by the opioid epidemic, we see they're the same as those at the center of the mortality crisis.
What we've seen is a very sharp increase in prescription opioid overdoses in women. I think one of the reasons is that middle-aged women are more likely to receive treatment for a chronic pain problem from a doctor. They're more likely to be prescribed prescription opioids.
The same is true of the middle-aged, who are more likely than the young to be prescribed and overdose on opioids. And addiction and overdose rates are higher amongst poor and working-class communities. So we can see the pieces of the mortality puzzle coming together. But there's something else.
This epidemic is almost completely white. It's so white that it's fair to say that it's protective in some ways to be African-American or Latino.
That's a dramatic statement, and in stark contrast to the heroin epidemic of the 70s or the crack epidemic of the 80s that devastated minority communities. But that history might offer a surprising explanation.
What I think may be happening is that if the patient is black, the doctor is more concerned about the possibility of the patient becoming addicted, or they're more concerned about the possibility of the patient selling their pills. What I think is going on is that racial stereotyping is having a protective effect on non-white populations.
In 2007, Purdue Pharma pleaded guilty to misleading doctors and patients about the addictive properties of OxyContin and paid $600 million in fines. It's also reformulated OxyContin to deter abuse, and the government has made changes to prescribing guidelines for doctors. But opioid-related deaths are still setting new records each year.
That report by Stateside's partner, the BBC's James Fletcher. In 1999, there were 99 heroin or opioid overdose deaths in Michigan. In 2014, that number stood at 1,001. That's 10 times as many deaths in just 15 years, according to the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. As we continue our series, Minding Michigan, we turn now to a woman who is a recovering opioid addict. These days, she's working to keep others on the path to recovery. Christy Kopek is a recovery coach with Victory Clinical Services in Saginaw, and she's a member of Peer 360, which is an organization of people who are in recovery. Christy Kopek, welcome.
Hi.
Tell us how old you were when you first started using.
I was about 16 years old when I first started using.
And what did you start with?
I had actually started smoking marijuana, and there was really no reason for it. I basically did it because the friends that I was hanging out with and my boyfriend at the time was doing it, and to me, it seemed cool, and I wanted to fit in.
And what effect did that have on you?
Well, in the beginning, I liked the effects, to be honest with you, but as time went on, it affected my grades, my job, my life, the other friends that I had. It affected my whole life all the way around.
And then when did you start using opioids, and what did you use? How did that begin?
I was 17 when I first used opiates. I had actually taken a couple Vicodin that my boyfriend that I was with at the time had gotten. We actually were at a party, and, you know, he said it would be fun and it would make you feel relaxed. And it was like smoking marijuana, but it was more intense than that. So I took them, and honestly, it was all over with from there. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what I was doing or what I was getting myself into. I thought I was just having fun.
What was the feeling like of taking it? When you were saying it was all over at the time, are you trying to say, gee, it felt so good that, this is terrific?
Yes, in a sense. It made me feel relaxed. I mean, I was in high school and stuff and, you know, had always struggled with having friends and I was shy. It took all of that away.
And as you say, it was all over even though you didn't know it at the time. What did you mean by that?
That in just taking that first pill, I didn't know it at the time, but I was instantly addicted after that. Mm. I liked it so much, and I wanted to do it more and more often that I became addicted after that first pill.
And then how long were you using into the point where you realized, boy, I've got a problem? And did you ever use that word addict in thinking about yourself?
No, I didn't. Not in the beginning. No, not at all. It was probably almost a year after I took the first pill that I had realized that there might be something wrong. I didn't know. I mean, I took DARE in elementary school, but I didn't know what a drug addict was. I mean, I had my perception of them and the stigma that goes along with them and people that you see in the streets, but I didn't know that anybody could be a drug addict, and I didn't know the effects of being an addict and being sick when you didn't have it and all of that. So I knew nothing about that. When I started waking up in the morning feeling sick or tired when I didn't have it, that's when I realized that I think there's something wrong.
Now, but you never crossed over to using heroin, did you?
I did a couple times, but only when I couldn't get what I wanted. I actually used OxyContin, which people say is synthetic heroin, and that's what I used.
Ultimately, then, with your road to recovery, Christy, what worked for you? What got you to a point where you can say, I am a recovering addict?
I guess going through everything that I had gone through, meeting the people that I did, going to NA meetings, and then I guess basically being around the people that I had been around and hearing their stories and seeing what it was like for them to live life clean and sober. And I wanted that life. I wanted to wake up in the morning and not be sick and have to go chase drugs and call people and wait. And I didn't want to have to do that anymore. So I decided that it was time for me to get clean. I had also had two kids, and I wanted to be there for them as a parent. I had seen a lot of people who had their kids taken away who will never see their kids again, and I didn't want to put my kids through that. That's the point when I realized that I want to be in recovery. I need to be in recovery.
How many tries did it take?
It actually took me about seven tries. Seven. But I only one time I went to an inpatient treatment center. Every other time I tried to do it by myself, alone, with nothing and no one to support me, which after I learned more about it, I realized that's not the way to go.
Which is why, for you working as a recovery coach, you realize that as you look at other people trying to get clean and not use.
Yes, definitely. You have to have a good support system and go to NA or even AA meetings. And it helps a lot if you have family that support you, or even a friend, or even just a recovery coach. Having one other person there that you can talk to when you need to helps a lot.
Christy, was there a program that clicked for you? Was it NA, Narcotics Anonymous, or what was it that really turned the key for you?
Honestly, I had gotten into a methadone program, and that was what clicked for me. That was what worked for me. Some people don't agree with methadone, but ultimately it saved my life. When I got on methadone, I was about to get both of my kids taken away. I had no job. I was sick looking, and from where I was when I started to where I am now is like night and day. I'm a completely different person.
And the idea that, as we were saying, as a recovery coach, you can look someone in the eye and say, I know exactly what you're going through, and what you say, those words matter, don't they?
Yes, a lot. When I had first started getting clean and stuff, I didn't have anybody like that. In doing the job that I do, I wish I had, because I think that it would have helped a lot. It maybe would have made things easier to be close to someone that had been in my shoes and been through the same exact stuff I had to, just to know that I can get through it, that other people have gotten through it, so I know that I can get through it.
Christy, do we need changes in the way that opioid drugs are labeled?
Yes, I think we need changes in the way that they're prescribed. Honestly, I think that too many doctors are too quick to prescribe them for everything. Obviously, if you've had surgery or something like that, I mean, it's okay. But I've been given pain pills for having a tooth pulled, something that Motrin would work for. Honestly, I think the way they label the bottles, I think there should be more of a warning on them, maybe right on them, that, you know, you can get addicted to this and to be careful taking it. And I've always been told that when a doctor gives you a prescription for some kind of opiates, you're supposed to be weaned off of them so that you don't get addicted to them. Because when you're taking pills like that for, you know, any kind of amount of time, when you stop taking them, you're going to feel sick. So you're supposed to slowly be weaned off of them. And I honestly have never heard of any doctor doing that.
And really, it's on patients as well to not expect to walk out with a prescription in hand, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But there was actually one time when I went to the dentist and I had my wisdom teeth pulled, and they had offered me Vicodin, and I told them I didn't want them, and I had asked for ibuprofen. And they told me, they flat out told me no, that the ibuprofen wouldn't work, that you needed that I needed the Vicodin. Mm. And they pushed it on me and pushed it on me after I told them I didn't want the prescription, and they gave me the prescription anyways. They insisted that I needed it, and there's no reason for that at all.
And what are the warning signs that we should watch for that might tell us that a friend or a coworker or a loved one could be getting addicted to opiates?
I think the big thing would definitely be changes in their mood swings, a lot of signs of somebody going through withdrawals is like sweating and watery eyes and yawning a lot and can't sit still. They can't sit still. They're really agitated, loss of appetite. Some people lose a lot of weight. But the main thing is the mood swings and not being able to sit still, really jittery and things like that.
So if someone's listening to what you're saying, Christy, and they're ticking off things going, yep, check, check. So mm-hmm. there's someone I love, I'm worried about. What then? How do you bring that up to the person who's possibly using?
Honestly, I think it kind of depends on the person. Mm. I think it depends on their mental stability, whether they get upset about things easily or not. Usually in that situation, though, you have to approach it very carefully because it can really upset some people and make them take off and go do more. But you have to be really careful. Maybe sit down with them and, you know, ask them what's been going on, how have you been doing, and, you know, are you still taking the pain medication or whatever it is they're doing, and ask them if they think they have it under control or if they have a problem, and maybe slowly ease into it from there. You really have to be careful with it. The first time that my parents ever approached me with it, I flipped out on them. Because a lot of people initially don't want to admit that, and they don't want to think about it, that they've become addicted to it, because nobody wants that. And it almost makes you feel like a horrible person. So when somebody else approaches you and confronts you on it and asks you about it, you get upset because you don't want to admit it yourself. So when somebody else sees it, it makes it worse. But you have to be very careful how you approach it.
Christy Kopech is a recovery coach. She is 6 years in recovery from opiate addiction. She's with Victory Clinical Services in Saginaw and also a member of Peer 360, which is an organization of people in recovery. Christy, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us and insights. And I know that you continue to work to help people, and I know you've done that through this interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.